Hi, I'm Chelsea Clinton, and this is In Fact, a podcast about why public health matters. After so much grief, fear, and uncertainty, I know many people are eager to put COVID-19 behind us, but we're not out of the woods yet. And there are so many lessons that we must learn from this pandemic to be better prepared for the next one. COVID-19 isn't the first pandemic that has swept the globe. The 1918 flu pandemic infected one-third of the world's population. And in more recent history, the Obama administration created a pandemic playbook for how to address, quote, a high-consequence emerging disease threat anywhere in the world, because public health officials have long worried that there could be another global pandemic. So just how unprecedented has this last year been? What have we learned from past crises? What can we learn from this one? And how prepared is our country and our world for the next pandemic? We're talking about all of this with someone who has become, for many, the public face of our government's response to COVID-19, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci was appointed director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases back in 1984, during a hugely consequential moment in the HIV/AIDS pandemic. His research was crucial to understanding how the virus works, and he was one of the leading architects of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, which has helped save millions of lives around the world. He's advised 7 presidents on how to prevent, diagnose, and treat a long list of infectious diseases, including HIV/AIDS, respiratory infections, diarrheal diseases, tuberculosis, malaria, Ebola, and Zika. He's been leading the U.S. government's efforts to combat this pandemic, working nonstop with his team and communicating consistently and honestly with Americans every step of the way. I was honored to welcome him to the podcast. So, Dr. Fauci, it's become almost a cliche to say this is an unprecedented time. And I'm just curious, given that you have lived through other pandemics, worked in other pandemics, how much of this feels unprecedented and how much of it feels eerily familiar?
Well, Chelsea, the only eerily familiar thing about it is the unpredictable nature of outbreaks, where you're just going along and then all of a sudden something comes up. It could be subtle, the way HIV this month, in the next few days, we're commemorating the 40th anniversary of the realization that we were dealing with a new syndrome. We didn't know what the microbe, the pathogen was. We didn't even have a name for it back in June and July of 1981. Having had, I guess I would call it the privilege in some respects, but also the painful experience of being involved in that from the very first day, that sort of snuck up on you. It was low level, below the radar screen. Then as we learned more and more about it, we found out we were dealing with just the tip of the iceberg when we saw people who were very, very sick, not knowing until we had a test that we were dealing with something where there were literally millions of people infected. So the fact that outbreaks are unpredictable, they come in strange ways, that's the common denominator. The difference with this that validates the statement it's unprecedented is that when you're dealing with something as explosive as this, which has a couple of characteristics that I have often referred to almost ironically years ago as, what is your worst nightmare, Dr. Fauci? People would ask me that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and longer. I would always say it was the emergence of a new virus, generally jumping species from an animal host to a human, that had two characteristics. One, that it is extraordinarily efficient in spreading from human to human. And two, that it has the capability of a great degree of morbidity and mortality. And when you put those two things together, that's when you get my worst nightmare. And that's exactly what we're experiencing, because we have not had anything like this in well over 100 years since the historic influenza pandemic of 1918. So there is a very strong, true element of this being unprecedented, at least in over 100 years.
You know, and Dr. Fauci, there's an adage in public health that outbreaks are inevitable, but epidemics aren't. Now, with the benefit of both hindsight and your decades of experience in pandemics, what do you think we could have done differently in January or February to help save American lives and save lives across the globe?
Yeah. In some respects, it is not answerable because you could certainly have done things differently if you knew things differently. So you could say to yourself, in this country, what could we have done if we knew back in January what we know right now is the characteristics that I'm telling you, its extraordinary ability to efficiently spread from human to human. The fact that 50 to 60% of the transmissions occur from someone who is infected but has no symptoms at all. We know anywhere from a third to 40% of the people who get infected never develop any significant symptoms at all that would bring attention to any medical intervention. So back then, if we knew that we were dealing with, in this country, something as extraordinary as this in its ability to spread, we would have done something that likely would have not been acceptable to the American public. Like when we had the first case in, I think it was January 21st, to say, okay, it's here. And then a few days later or a week or two later, it became clear that there was community spread. It's just there, which means someone infected someone and you don't have the chain of transmission locked in. You don't know where the person got it from. That being the case, that means it's spreading in society beneath the radar screen. If we had known its capability of spreading, we could have said, let's shut the country down right now to prevent it. I think there would have been such extraordinary pushback to say, well, wait a minute, what are you talking about? We have one or two cases. You want to shut the country down? That's crazy. So when you ask me a question, what could we have done differently? Well, now that we have 590,000 deaths, you go back and say, wow, look what this has done. We maybe could have prevented some of those had we really shut down earlier and prevented the spread. But, you know, if you look throughout the world, Chelsea, even countries that appear to have done well early on, every country has gotten hit really badly. Even some of the Asian countries now that we pointed to as models of their response are now starting to get into trouble, including places like Taiwan and Singapore and Vietnam and places like that, who seem to have done very well on the first waves. You made a comment that resonates with me, is how do you prevent an outbreak from becoming a pandemic? So I don't think we're necessarily going to be able to prevent the emergence of new microbes. They've occurred historically for as long as and before history even recorded it. History is full of them. But in answer to your question, how do you prevent that from becoming a pandemic? And that's when we talk about lessons learned. What can we learn having gone through this, where the United States was ranked by public health agencies as being the best prepared country in the world for a pandemic? And we got hit among the top three with Brazil and India as the three worst in the sense of numbers of cases and deaths.
And Dr. Fauci, do you think that that is because we were prepared for previous pandemics and not future ones? I mean, were we ready to fight the last war and not the next war?
I think it's partially that, not completely. I think it was. There were things that went wrong early on, and that was the issue with the testing, that we didn't have a good testing system for a considerable period of time. And we were testing only symptomatic people because we're not fully aware that asymptomatic spread was really, really very important. So those are the things that I think could have been done differently. And then, you know, I don't want to relitigate what went on last year, but there were things that I think could have been done better.
Although I live in New York now, I grew up in Arkansas and then moved when I was 12 to D.C., and it is heartbreaking to me, Dr. Fauci, that Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, so much of the South have vaccination rates that are half of what we see in the Northeast. Since you've had to communicate now over so many decades, so many different public health challenges and also imperatives, how do you think we rebuild trust in science and especially trust in vaccines and vaccinations?
That is something that is not going to happen easily, Chelsea. I think that we may have to find ways, and that's a complicated issue, as you will know probably better than I do. It's a complicated issue of how you heal the differences and the hostility I mean, I've been the object myself of a phenomenal amount of hostility merely because I'm promoting what are really fundamental, simple public health principles. That seems astounding that that would generate a considerable degree of hostility. But it is. It is. So I don't think the answer is intensifying the hostility and pointing fingers. I think the approach is to outreach, to try and understand each other better and realize that we have differences, but those differences should be the source, you know, of strength in some respects and not the source of chaos. So I don't know the answer to your question. It's a seemingly simple question with a complicated answer. We've got to reach out to people and get them to understand that this is for their own safety, their own health, and also what I refer to as communal responsibility, your responsibility to society, because there is a thing called the chain of transmission of an outbreak. And one of the very interesting, and I must say quite unique aspects of SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 is that the same virus that has killed almost 600,000 Americans makes many, many people have no symptoms at all. It just doesn't bother them. I mean, there's 30, 40% of the people get no symptoms at all. So that is in many respects unprecedented to have that situation. Usually when you have something as potentially deadly as this, it makes just about everybody a little bit sick. This is something where there were people who were saying, why should I get vaccinated? The chances of my getting into trouble are very, very low. And they're correct. If you look at the rate of hospitalizations of young people, it's not zero. It's small compared to the rate among elderly people and among people with underlying conditions. But there are a couple of things there that people don't fully understand. You're not completely exempt because a lot of young people wind up getting into trouble. Statistically, not nearly as many as the elderly and those with underlying conditions. But there's another aspect of it. Let's say you get infected and you don't get any symptoms at all. And you can say, there, see, I got infected, big deal. What's the difference? The difference is that it is conceivable and maybe likely that even though you got no symptoms, that you would inadvertently and innocently, I'll use that word, pass it on to someone else, who would then pass it on to someone else, who would then get a serious consequence. So there is a degree that have to consider of what is my societal responsibility of not being part of the chain of transmission, as opposed to being a dead end for the virus. So do you want to be a dead end for the virus? Or do you want to be a situation where you're part of the transmission chain, which would get other people in trouble? But that's tough to get that concept across.
Well, I mean, Dr. Fauci, I never thought I would say I wanted to be a dead end. But yes, here I am, like very happy to be fully vaccinated and a dead end. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I do, though, want to ask about preparedness, because I think probably a lot of people are now, as we are vaccinating the country, I know a lot of people want to put COVID in the rearview mirror, leave it in 2021, not worry about it again. But we know that the virus is not done with us until we have everyone vaccinated. And we know we need to learn lessons from this to help better prepare us going forward. So what lessons do you think we need to learn? And how do you think your work at the NIH has to adapt? How do you think the Biden administration has to adapt? What concrete things have to happen to ensure we are better prepared for the inevitable next time?
Okay, so two components to my answer, Chelsea. The first is that when you're dealing with a global pandemic, you have to have a global response. We're not going to be safe on this planet until the pandemic is controlled globally. So right away, it is not necessarily a lesson, but almost a mandate that we really need to help the rest of the world as a rich country get this under control. Because if there's still viral dynamics somewhere, even if we get this under very good control here, there's always the danger of the generation of variants, which then would make our protection somewhat tenuous, even with the vaccines. That's the first thing. when you look at the future, what lessons learned for the future, we need to also prepare in a global way. There was a thing called the Global Health Security Network or the Global Health Security Agenda, where you have interconnectivity among countries of the world, good, modern, up-to-date communications, sharing of reagents, sharing of specimens, continued good collaboration and communication, building up in the local areas the public health infrastructure that would allow them to respond and quench something when it breaks out in any given country. Because outbreaks generally don't start spontaneously in 25 countries. They generally start as a jumping of species, usually, not always, from an animal reservoir to a human, and then it spreads to the rest of the world. That doesn't mean that you got to blame the country where it happened. It just so happens. But you've got to have those countries prepared to be able to contain it. So that's the thing with preparedness. The other thing, from a scientific standpoint, is that we are very fortunate that we have made decades and decades of investment in basic and clinical biomedical research, which has allowed us to do something that's unprecedented, to get a vaccine in which a virus was first identified in January of 2020, and then in December of that same year, 11 months later, to be putting vaccine into people's arms that's 94 to 95% efficacious. If we were having this conversation 10 years ago, you would have told me I was completely crazy thinking that that would happen. It usually takes years and years. And the speed was not because we were reckless in doing things and cutting corners. The speed was related to the extraordinary amount of investment that was made over the previous decades in clinical and basic research. So there are another component of lessons learned. We need to continue to make the investments in research that will allow us to have the scientific component of the response be optimal. And fortunately for us, that's what happened with regard to the vaccines.
Dr. Fauci, you mentioned earlier the Global Health Security Agenda, which, while it had antecedents over many years, really got codified in the aftermath of Ebola and of the United States saying what has happened in Western Africa is clearly a tragedy for people there, but it is a danger to us here too. And we do need to have more robust public health architecture everywhere. And then that wasn't a priority for the Trump administration, but it wasn't really a priority for the world. I do admittedly have a little bit of a concern that once we are through COVID-19, I worry we might lose focus on the need to build robust global architecture to help protect public health everywhere.
Well, Chelsea, I definitely share your concern. And the reason I do is from my experience in that corporate memory for things that have been very, very difficult in the sense of responding and preparing is often short-lived. And when you put this behind us, we will be dealing with problems that are real and present. Yet it's difficult to get people to understand that the threat of an outbreak is perpetually a real and present danger. So what we've got to do as a globe, as a planet, as a community of nations, is to just make sure we tell ourselves that when we get this under control, that we've got to say never again and mean it. And never again means to really put the effort into the kind of preparation that will require considerable resources. And even though it's tough to convince people to give resources to something that isn't happening now, we've got to call back the memory of 2019, 2020, and 2021. Because as we started off in the beginning of this podcast, the fact is that this is really what happened to us. It just came out of nowhere and it just immobilized us for such an extraordinary period of time. I mean, we're in our second year now. The economy has been wrecked by this for sure, not only here in the United States. Thank goodness we're recovering now, but it's still a lot of people out of work. I think those kinds of memories should spur us on to make sure we are adequately prepared next time around.
Well, and hopefully will spur us on, returning to a comment that you made earlier that I am in vigorous agreement with, that we have a responsibility to help vaccinate the world. And while I certainly appreciate President Biden's commitment to donate 70 million doses by July 4th, we know we can't effectively donate our way out of this. So I am curious, Dr. Fauci, if we think about the architecture that we really need to help protect public health globally, while often the focus is on surveillance and specimen collecting, testing, what do you think it should be for vaccine research and development, for example, or the actual ability to manufacture and to guarantee the quality of vaccines in the next generation?
I'm with you 100% on that. And that is referring to building up the capacity and the ability to do technology transfer so that when you have an outbreak, it isn't only companies in Switzerland, the United States, and the UK, but you have plants and companies and technology and the knowledge to do it in Senegal and Ethiopia and South Africa and Indonesia and Brazil and Chile, so that when you have an outbreak, you do have the capability. And that is building up not only the infrastructure of public health to do surveillance and monitoring, but also the ability to respond at a global level. To rely on donations is a quick, immediate, partial fix. But the real durable, sustainable fix now in the future is to allow other countries that generally don't have that capacity to be able to make vaccine in a timely fashion and not depend completely on donations from the rich country. The rich country should donate if they have to. But the real ultimate solution is to have a world where it's evenly distributed, where there's equity and opportunity to make your own countermeasures. In this case, it would be vaccines and therapeutics.
We're taking a quick break. Stay with us. Dr. Fauci, you mentioned earlier that you've been under quite a bit of personal attack for talking about things that should be, I would argue, like fairly non-controversial, like the importance of vaccines and vaccinations. And we know that so many of our public health officials have been under inordinate stress, working day after day without rest to try to help protect public health over the last year and a half. And we know that many public health officials have also received, you know, horrific abuse, and that the mental health toll has been really immense. What do you think we need to do to try to help support everyone who's really been on the front lines to recover from this horrifically stressful time, as hopefully we recover as a country?
Yeah, well, you're pointing out something that I think everyone hopefully will ultimately recognize is the extraordinary courage and effort that has been put in by our frontline healthcare workers. I mean, they truly are the heroes and the heroines of this. The physical risk that they took, are taking to take care of people, the physical and mental strain of seeing people every single day dying right in front of you with very little that you can do, particularly when you're dealing with people who have underlying conditions in which when they get hospitalized, they're in very, very difficult straits. It's a reality. We've lost close to 590,000 people in this country. That's terrible for the losses of those people and their families. But what people don't appreciate, because I've been there, and I know what it means, the terrible strain and stress when you're trying your best to save someone's life and they just lose them person after person after person. We've got to pay attention to the stress and probably a good degree of post-traumatic stress that those people will have. So I think attention to mental health issues is something we really absolutely have a responsibility to do for people who've given it everything and yet have exhausted themselves in the process.
You know, Dr. Fauci, I want to be respectful of your time. I also want to end on an optimistic note. We spoke earlier about how the COVID-19 vaccines were accelerated through just extraordinary amounts of attention and investment and collaboration really across the globe. And so I just am curious, what else that is being worked on currently at the NIH do you think is close to a breakthrough and that could similarly really help save and protect a lot of lives soon?
Yeah, and it's in multiple fields of medicine, not just infectious disease. But one of the things that we're having a lot of optimism now, you know, we've done spectacularly well in the development of life-saving drugs for persons living with HIV to the point now, if you're infected, you get put on one pill that contains three drugs and you can go essentially lead almost a normal lifespan. So we've done well there. The thing that has been the challenge is the vaccine for HIV. But I believe some of the technologies that have been developed and shown to be highly successful, like the mRNA vaccine platform technology for COVID-19, is now being actively pursued in the field of HIV and in other areas of medicine, including cancer and other infectious diseases. That's what I think is perched for breakthroughs. Also, in the field of immunotherapy for cancer, I mean, the more we learn about how we can control the regulation of the immune system, there are going to be cancers that have been beyond the reach of cures that likely will now, for the first time, see that you can actually marshal the immune system's response. Cancer immunotherapy has been, in some areas, quite successful, but in some areas, still very frustrating. I think you're going to see a lot of that frustration turn to good results within a reasonable period of time. So there's never been a time more exciting in the field of biomedical research than now. And that's the reason why we are so grateful for the support that we continue to get from the Congress and from multiple administrations, because it certainly has given us an extraordinary tool for COVID-19. If it were not for that, we would be in much, much more dire straits than we are right now with regard to this pandemic.
Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for your leadership and for your time today, for giving me kind of things to be optimistic about, but also, of course, things to still worry about and work on. So thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Chelsea. I appreciate you having me on your show. Thank you.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the U.S. National Institutes of Health, or the NIH. If you're not yet vaccinated, go to vaccines.gov to find a vaccine site near you. And anyone can visit wecandothis.hhs.gov to join in a month of action to help get as many people vaccinated as possible. And volunteers, even if you're vaccinated, who take at least 5 actions may be invited to the White House in July. And as we reflect on what our country has been through, let's keep listening to scientists and experts like Dr. Fauci and his team. Let's keep asking hard and important questions so that we can learn from what's worked and what hasn't, so we are better prepared for the inevitable next time. And to any of our listeners who have been on the front lines of this crisis as a nurse, doctor, researcher, or anyone else in the world of public health, thank you. Our country owes you a huge debt of gratitude. And I hope that you're taking care of your own health too, physically and mentally. In Fact is brought to you by iHeartRadio. We're produced by Erica Goodmanson, Lauren Peterson, Kathy Russo, Julie Subrin, and Justin Wright, with help from the Hidden Light team of Barry Lurie, Sarah Horowitz, Nikki Huggett, Emily Young, and Huma Abedin, with additional support from Lindsay Hoffman. Original music is by Justin Wright. If you liked this episode of In Fact, please make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and tell your family and friends to do the same. If you really want to help us out, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week.